Welcome to Everything Belongs, a podcast exploring the subtleties of living, creating, leading, and thriving while in the deep end of life. I'm your host, Madison Morgan, and here with me and my weekly guests, you can expect curious and brave conversations all centering around what it means to live into the process of awakening to our worth, wholeness, and power. We will talk about personal, collective, and spiritual freedom, riff on sovereign leadership, living in levity, and bridge the mystical with the down-to-earth and practical. There is not much we shy away from here, because at this table, everything belongs. Well, hello there. Madison here, coming to you from my cozy meditation room in Springfield, Missouri, where I am still in a robe because it is Christmas break and it's the day after the darkest day on record when I'm recording this. And I'm just feeling cozy, so cozy. I've been off social media and have completed my final client calls and group calls for 3 weeks. I realized last week that I never took a proper vacation this year, because I'm always unplugging on vacation, that I never did that, which might explain some tiredness and some craving for solitude and some craving for inward time. So I'm in this little container I've made for myself of liminal space, liminal time between now and the week after the new year. And that's where I'm coming to you from my meditation room, where I am pretty much spending most of my days at this point, at least half of the day, reading and writing and being alone by myself. And I felt prompted at a last minute, you know, I actually had a podcast scheduled for today that'll come out next week, but I felt prompted to do something a little bit different today. And instead of just offering another interview, I want to have a little bit more fun. I want to self-express a bit, and I want to share what prompted me to start the podcast, offering some of the highs and lows of my own creative process and walking through one of the most challenging yet expanding years of my entire life. And then I want to recap the top 3 episodes of the year. So first, let's have a little podcast backstory. So I launched into 2020 after a year of heartbreak, new love, and rearranging my entire life to be more aligned with my deeper truth. Those of you who've been following me for a while know a little bit about that journey, but I was in a long-term committed relationship with my then husband that I chose to transition out of and come out as queer. And of course, that alignment feels wonderful. It feels so good to be myself, and to fully express myself in the world. But the changes I chose to make in my life left reverberations past 2019 that I was honestly ready to leave in the past starting into 2020. Last Christmas in 2019 was my first no contact holiday with certain family members. And because I was also newly out, I didn't feel comfortable yet seeing the other side of my family, who was very religious and conservative. We weren't necessarily on bad terms. I just needed more time to be in my own process, to build my own comfortability with new and emerging identities, and to be in my own process without adding the reactions of others. So I chose to do the holidays alone, and with my new girlfriend, which was beautiful and yet had its own sense of grief. It was also my first holiday last year in 10 years spent without my ex-husband. I spent a decade with him and doing holidays together. And so in a way, all of my traditions and all of my sense of family was collapsed. I signed the divorce papers on New Year's Eve last year, 2019, and that was 6 months to the day of moving out in my uncoupling ceremony. So in a very short amount of time, so many things changed in my life around family and around belonging. So coupled with the lagging grief of change and the excitement of new life, New Year's Eve was actually the first outing I had with my girlfriend, where I felt boldly liberated to dance together as an out queer woman in my small mid-sized Midwestern town. And I was with my people, right? I was with people I loved, but there was still that anxiety there for me. In a bubblegum pink suit, a mesh leopard print shirt, and kitten heels, I was nervous and highly aware I kissed my girlfriend on the dance floor, felt eyes on me, and most of which were probably more surprised than judgy, given my long-standing religious stint that most people in my town knew me through. I allowed that night my inhibitions to fall away, promising myself that 2020 was going to be the year I felt more free to be me than ever and really go after what I wanted. And that first week of the new year, the first week of 2020, I flew to Hawaii to host a spiritual healing and trauma retreat with Varvara Eroshina and Dr. Hillary McBride, feeling more connected to my purpose than ever. I remember the warmth of the air arriving and just dancing together and feeling the gratitude for following the breadcrumbs in the years past. Hillary's work on the Liturgist podcast helped me leave evangelicalism. Varvara's work and her friendship through long text threads about falling in love with a woman supported me to normalize my feelings. She never rushed my process, but always honored me, knowing what it's like to be a queer woman having left Christianity. My best friend, Kinsey, joined me in Hawaii the week after the retreat, and she's the brilliant mind behind most of my photography for my website and Instagram photos since I started my career. She met us for some playtime after the retreat, and she was the first person I told I was attracted to a woman. She was the first person I shared in years past that I no longer believed in God as I knew them. And she had been my loyal confidant, my divorce honeymoon buddy, and my biggest dream bigger buddy for years. So I started 2020 surrounded by love, support, and palm trees. And all of that was manifestations of desires, hard work, and choosing my belonging time and time again, making really difficult choices time and time again. And things just felt right that week. Things felt like they were falling into place, and that 2020 was off to this start where I was really going to, I suppose, come into myself in a way that I hadn't previously. I remember listening to Channy Nicholas on the To Be Magnetic podcast on the plane ride home, talking about the energy of 2020. And I actually remember being like severely disappointed in the interview, but I don't remember the exact words, and that wasn't Channy's fault. It was an interviewer thing, but the interviewer asked something to the effect of, so would you say 2020 is going to be like the year to really go after your dreams? And this isn't an exact quote, but Channy said something to the effect of, well, sure, if your dreams involve social justice, global movement, and the fall of all systemic structures of oppression. And I was like, oh, shit. It sent shivers down my spine. And I thought, like, this is what I'm made for. I'm made for building the new world. I'm made for this. And it actually invigorated me. And I found it quite humorous that the person interviewing her, which wasn't Lacey Phillips that day, it was someone else, really seemed taken aback by Channy's bluntness about the transformative energy of 2020. And I think many of us didn't quite know how much the year would reveal to us, how much personally I would learn what I was made for, what I was made of. So fast forward a few months, we are in early March, and I was in Sedona for the Sedona Yoga Festival, where my girlfriend Jamie was set to teach. And not only was I super excited to be there in support of her, but I was also going to try to meet Marianne Williamson, who was speaking. And driving there, I heard Marianne on the radio, and the talk of coronavirus was amping up, and she was talking about it. And at that point, I wasn't really sure how serious to take it. Given as I was scrolling social media, I was starting to see predominant thought leaders posting about alien invasions and mass volcano eruptions and government mind control. So this talk of coronavirus was just thrown in with some really far conspiracy theories. And someone I was actually with on that trip started to go off about pedophile rings. So I was doing my best to stay centered and be open to information that was difficult. But after hosting my mastermind Rising Sovereigns monthly call from Sedona, it became really clear to me the distress and fear that everyone was feeling collectively. Rising Sovereign is a program of leaders, teachers, coaches, therapists, artists, people who are actively leading and who have a lot of influence over other people. simply by way of their leadership, sometimes even social media following, etc. And so together on that call, I remember just sitting together feeling confused and scared and overwhelmed, and none of us had answers. Very shortly after that call, the Sedona Yoga Festival shut down and never happened. We canceled our flights and things escalated quite quickly. We drove home 18 hours, weaving our way through Texas, peeing and dancing on the side of the roads. So we didn't have to stop anywhere. And when we got home, I let out a big cry, immediately quarantined at my girlfriend's house because I had a roommate at the time that I didn't want to expose via my travel. And I unintentionally bumped up my move-in date by a month as lockdown set in. So I moved into my girlfriend's house. And I think I actually said at one point after, you know, getting there and settling in, how much I was enjoying the forced lockdown. Despite all the fear and uncertainty, we did our best to stay positive. We did some spring cleaning, had the windows open, were Netflix binging, work planning, decorating. And things were feeling oddly wonderful. And it wasn't 2 weeks later that my dog, Nova, tragically ran into the street and was hit by a car and died not 10 minutes after the incident. And goodness, that really sent me to another place of grief. It was only 24 hours after that that I hosted the next Rising Sovereign call and did so with tears in my eyes, a lump in my throat, allowing myself to show up honestly. But the honest truth is that I was not okay. I was full of grief and newly engaged in some deep trauma work that I had already committed to around relationship with my family. And it kind of seemed like all of the spaces of home that I had tried to create for myself, all the spaces of safety, had been, but either by choice or by life choosing for me, ripped out from under me, all while the pandemic was setting in. And I think this is the point, you know, in 2020 where all of us really went into a collective state of panic. The next few months really felt like a blur as political uprisings brought to light the disparity in America around Black lives. I remember feeling thankful for having done anti-racist work for the couple years prior. So I was able to support some people. I was able to support clients and friends who were new to the work, while also being highly ill-equipped in a lot of other ways, having clients of marginalized identities, having Black clients, having queer clients, and feeling like I was really failing in my leadership at that point. I made mistakes in this season. I was grieving while I was leading, while we were also going through a global pandemic. It was a lot. And reconciling my own limitations while holding space for a group of leaders whose political opinions actually started to fray out became one of the most testing experiences of my leadership to date. I was facilitating sacred circle about sovereignty amidst some of the deepest grief and life change I'd personally ever undergone. And like many, I was scared and confused, and I was learning in public, and I was doing my best, and my best consistently felt short of my own expectations. In that season, I held space for people who were being publicly called out, some people being lied about, some people who were survivors of racial harm and gender-based violence seeking deeper healing. I was holding space for some people who didn't really understand what they called the big deal about race. I was holding space for Trump supporters, Biden supporters, abolitionists, anarchists, and those who chose to be apolitical during that time and chose not to take a stand. I tried to understand. I tried to make bridges, and I tried to hold steady in myself, knowing that as a facilitator, my role is to hold space. But as a white woman doing this work, knowing that my work and my responsibility is also deeper. And there were a lot of tensions to hold there for me. There were times that I epically failed, caused harm, and times that I was able to offer space for understanding, deeper humanity, and greater connection. And the whole time through that season, I kept asking, I continued to keep asking myself, what is my role as a white, cis, queer woman with an online platform who leads? What is my role having come from conservative Christianity and left and given that perspective I hold? What is my role being trained in conflict resolution, mediation, and having understanding of trauma in the body? What is my role given my skills at depth coaching and facilitating? What is my role given what it takes to divest from internalized supremacy and not just show it on social media and be showing up politically to show who we stand by, but relationally, healing our codependence, healing the way supremacy shows up in our leadership, in the way that we relate? What is my role seeing colleagues canceled by other colleagues, seeing therapists canceled by other therapists online? What is my role and what isn't my role? Those have been two of the biggest questions that I've wrestled with this year. It was during this time of grief between March and July where there was overwhelm, a longing to build bridges and make a world more beautiful that this podcast became an idea and was born. When I launched this podcast 6 months ago, I did so knowing that I would give guests or have guests on that I probably wouldn't agree with in every area, but that I wanted to allow space for curiosity and messy humanness. I wanted to have space for leaders, healers, facilitators, creatives, survivors, harm doers, and people who learn in public and who are actively choosing to learn in public, which is really all of us now, right? Any of us that are on social media, anyone who posted a black square this year and then frantically took it down and frantically circulated money, even though you weren't feeling yourself, right? We're all learning in public, especially this year, to have a space to say, yeah, this too belongs. And everything belongs doesn't mean that we like everything happening. It doesn't mean that we agree with everyone's choices, that we uplift and celebrate people causing harm. It doesn't mean that we want to be experiencing the reality. It doesn't mean that we want to be feeling how we feel. And it doesn't mean that we have to be friends with everyone, but it does mean that if it exists, it belongs. That this too belongs, that 2020 belongs, that these people belong. Because what I saw in those few months of confusion, collective exhaustion, leaders perpetually fucking up and seeking to do better, some not seeking to do better, and searching for meaning in extremes, was the desire in all of us to make sense and find a pathway to wholeness. What I know about wholeness is that it comes with both sides of the coin, light and shadow. It comes recognizing that we too can cause harm. It comes realizing that we too have significant and greater impact than we could ever imagine. And it comes acknowledging the ways that we have been wrong. It comes with us being willing to be seen fucking up and shining bright, two sides of the same coin. And if I know anything, it's that true, long-lasting change doesn't happen when we shy away from our ugly bits, personally or collectively, the messy parts of leadership, or pretend that the pain is also the only thing that exists, because it's not. True change happens when we allow ourselves to reckon with all of humanity, the wholeness, the ugly parts, the beautiful parts, make room for beauty and grief alike, and to soften into it. Like so many of you, I entered the year wanting to rise and go up and up and up and up and up. And I've had very high expectations of people, including myself. I had people on pedestals, especially leaders, dehumanizing them, making them perfect in my own mind, only to be angry when they didn't hold up to those expectations. And 2020 disillusioned me. It brought me to my knees and showed me what humans are really made of, the ugly and beautiful alike, especially inside of myself. I wanted the grief of 2019 to be buried and to rise in my own sovereign leadership. And I did. I just didn't expect it to look like a descent, a descent into my body, my pain, my femininity, and addressing my greatest fears around public shame, belonging, and being the good girl. And that's where Everything Belongs came from the knowing that even the worst of us still deserve a place to land, and the best of us are usually so righteous that we would see our own mess and blame another person for it. Everything Belongs to me is the belief that real change does not come from casting out, but from welcoming in. Everything Belongs is human. We don't always like it, but it exists. Everything Belongs is acknowledging reality as our starting point to a world more beautiful. It is radical, transformative, and boundary grace with both a vision and a plan. Everything Belongs is inclusive and transcendent. It has been my greatest teacher this year, and I'm so grateful to have journeyed with you. Now, I want to share with you the top 5 podcasts that you downloaded this year that you thought were the most valuable to your personal life, the ones that you just listen to maybe again and again. And I want to highlight the top 3 here with my favorite parts, my favorite parts of those episodes. And what I'm taking away from the 5 most downloaded conversations from this podcast is that what you craved most this year was honesty around what it really means to be human, which tells me that you too felt the messy, ugly, grief-filled parts of leadership. It tells me I was not alone in this pain. It tells me that we needed one another and that leadership requires us to get into our bodies and deeply trust ourselves. So, your 5th most downloaded podcast was episode 10 with poet, model, and spoken word artist Arielle Astoria, titled Taking Risks to Find True Freedom. It was an episode about Arielle's vulnerable journey with God, faith, shifting relationships, and navigating building a career as an artist in LA. And it was such a powerful conversation. It's linked in the show notes if you want to go listen. The 4th most downloaded episode was episode 12 with my very first life coach, Steph Jagger, on rooting into the feminine and really anchoring into our descent, our bodies, our darkness, our pussy wisdom, and spiritual fertility. And now I want to share with little clips here on this episode the top 3 episodes of the year, starting with number 3, a personal favorite with also a sprinkle of controversy, episode 18 with Jamie Lee Finch, Punishment Programming and Boundaries on Social Media. Let's give it a listen.
The moment someone learns something, they've got to go on Canva and like type it out with a cute background and create a carousel so you can be like, look at this thing I'm an expert in. Like, you should follow me and know about it. And if you don't know about it, you're in big trouble when they just learned it 10 minutes ago. And no one's talking, no one's saying, hey, I just learned this 10 minutes ago. Like, isn't this fascinating? Ironically enough, Twitter's better at that than Instagram is, which is very fascinating. The amount of people I see on Twitter who are like, holy shit, I had no idea about this thing. And then they, you know, retweet or quote tweet.
The retweet process is better, I think, on Twitter.
Yes.
Because you can be like, hey, I just learned this from this person, which what I'm seeing on Instagram is fear of not knowing.
Yes. Yeah.
And it activating this, like, how do I front as if I already knew this?
Yeah.
Instead of, and not everyone is doing it, but I have seen over and over again that process happen. And it, like, I used the word smudge and someone messaged me and was like, I don't know if you should be smudging. And it was actually, what was it called? Rosemary. Mm-hmm. And so I misused the word. I actually didn't know that if you are indigenous to Celtic cultures, that it's not called smudging. Mm. I did know that rosemary was appropriate to be using and burning. And so 2 people reached out to me about this. And in general, I like welcome people being like, hey, I have this information. Like, I love to learn. So I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
And whenever I messaged back one of the people, I was like, oh, like, this is the information I've been reading. What have you been reading? Like, what information do you have about this for me to learn more if that's what you're telling me? And it was like, oh, I don't know. I heard from someone who heard from someone who heard from a Black woman that you're not supposed to be burning things. And I was like, okay, let's talk about this, because this is clearly, this is important. And I messaged my friend Becca, who actually I'm interviewing right after this, for an interview about white women reconnecting to ancestral ways. And seining wand was the appropriate term. And so mm-hmm. I was really thankful to learn that and to have that information, and found it so interesting that while being called out, called in, informed, that I actually wasn't being informed about anything.
Yeah,
I actually,
right.
I just was like, oh, cool. Here's three articles I just found on this. I'm grateful that this prompted me to go learn more. And I find it interesting that actually you didn't know when you messaged me.
Yeah. And that's the thing that I think makes me so uncomfortable. I'm not made uncomfortable by people saying, hey, if you don't know about this thing yet, like, here's some information so that you can maybe do better. What I'm uncomfortable with is the expectation of like perfection from strangers that you follow online, that like this idea that like everyone should know everything that there is to know about everything that they're making a personal choice about in any given moment. And if they don't, then you've got free rein to hop in to their DMs, even if you have no idea who the fuck they are. You somehow are under the impression you've got free rein to hop in and be like, hey, you need to fix this thing that you're doing. And then when that person, if they receive it well, and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't know, can you give me more information about where you got this information from? Because I legitimately want to learn. When it's then met with like, oh, I don't have that. I just saw you doing a thing that I think that you shouldn't do.
Yeah.
What? We don't do that. We literally don't do that to people anywhere but our phones. You don't walk around and do that to, I mean, none of us are walking around and doing anything to people right now anyway, because of COVID, but in normal life, don't just walk up to someone who's making a decision with their body out in the world in public, a total stranger, and say, hey, I think you should stop doing that thing. Well, first of all, that's weird. Second of all, if that person for whatever reason was like, interesting, can you tell me more about that? And if you followed up with like, well, I just think you shouldn't do it. Why are we doing this on the internet?
It's making us believe that we're doing activism work. And I think this is where it is. It's really activated me, because I've noticed my want to make sure that I'm showing what I'm doing so that I don't get in trouble.
Yes.
And so any of the money I'm donating, it feels gross to post about it. And also I feel this like peeing of, if you don't, people are going to think you're complicit.
That's right.
And then you're going to get in trouble.
But then if you do, people are going to say it's performative, and then you're going to get in trouble.
Right. And so this is the exact buzz. It's a buzzing and a pit. It feels like a pit deep inside my stomach, because I know exactly, you know, where it comes from in my history, and like where it comes from in this, you know, getting a text while I'm in school from my parents that says, we need to talk. And like that, that feeling of like, fuck, I'm like, my entire life is ruined. And in my life, the expectations were always changing. And this is where I want to be really cautious, because I think that these conversations are really important. I've had really beautiful conversations with people that I know, and I've intentionally made relationships and cultivated relationships with people who have difference, who know more politically than me and are more engaged politically, like particularly put myself in spaces to learn from Black women, because like I need to learn. Mm-hmm. And it's been through those relationships that I've experienced the most grace, the most expansion, the most education. And it came from relationship.
Yep.
Always with someone that I knew.
That's right.
And so it feels really interesting that we're all filling our heads up with this information, kind of like we're doing with mental health. Like, everyone's like gaslighting, narcissist. And I'm really grateful, as someone who suffered from narcissistic abuse, to have that language, because I know how much it served me. And there's this caution of reading 10 books on trauma and reading 10 books on anti-racism and thinking that you're doing it while in the safety of your own home and in no relationship with any people of color, but now you have your phone that you can just call out other, you can just police other white people. And it doesn't feel like regenerative to me in any way.
Because it's not. I can't see how it could be, because I think learning more and doing better can only happen through the context you just described of like relationships with people that you have a deep investment in and with, that you are learning from and that you are repaying in some capacity, whether that's financially or whatever energy you might be sending back, like there's an exchange happening. That's really the only space and way in which like accountability, it's like we've gotten real fucked about what we think that word means. And that word only belongs in the context of relationship. It can't belong anywhere, which is why, again, before we started recording, this like kind of like joke about like call out versus call in, we're like, they're the same fucking thing now. People just like feel like they're not allowed to call it calling out because people are now talking about how calling out is bad. You need to call in. But now you just still have comment warriors on Instagram who are total strangers saying, oh, I'm calling you in. What do you mean? I don't know you. Like I had a thing a few months ago with a white woman on Instagram who we had a private exchange in DMs and she kept using the word accountability. And I was like, I have had like 3 conversations with you on Instagram total. I don't know you. This is weird that you are under the impression. First of all, she like saw herself in a post I made where I was like, I'm seeing this behavior everywhere. And she private messaged me to say like, you're bullying me. And I was like, hold on. First of all, if you saw yourself in this, I don't really know what to tell you about that because I'm speaking to like a lot of behavior I'm seeing going on right now. If it was about you, I would just tell you, but also like, I hardly know you. So it was just weird. I was like, this is weird that you're seeing yourself in this in the first place. And then she started using words like accountability and bullying and gaslighting even at a certain point. And I was like, again, I'm disagreeing with you. That doesn't mean I'm gaslighting you. You're throwing these terms around that like are making me even less comfortable with the idea of continuing to engage with you in this discussion because you keep throwing up these, it's like we can't have a conversation about this because you have already decided it. And this is a thing I feel like happens a lot is like, you've already decided that I am on some opposing team to you, or you've already decided that. And again, there was even things like, you know, her perspective of like the way she defined and described what I was doing was because I just happened to be in a different like economic position as her, but I was making like creating a criticism that she saw herself in. She then said I was being classist. And I was like, how do these pieces fit? Like, you can't just like throw out information. You can't just throw out terms in this, like, just because like someone is saying something, like lobbing or not lobbing out, but like creating valid criticism about behavior that we're seeing happen. And just because that person checks different demographic boxes than you doesn't mean you automatically are like, oh, well, you can't criticize me because that's you being classist. Like, I don't know what words mean anymore at this point on the internet. Like, it's getting to a point where I'm like, I want to have these discussions in real life with people that I do have accountability with and for. I can't be friends with every person that I'm connected to on Instagram. If I can't have deeply invested friendships with every person that I'm connected to on Instagram, then there has to be a point where boundaries matter. There has to be a point where like, you don't get to assume things about me you don't know. I don't get to assume things about you I don't know. And if we can't have a relationship with one another, then we just don't have one. And then maybe I unfollow you. Maybe you unfollow me. Maybe we keep following each other's content. But this presumption that we're in relationship with one another because we have clicked a button on our phones is really absurd. And that's where I think we're getting into this, like, that's where I keep coming back to, like, I don't know what words mean when people say them. Like, when this woman I was having this conversation with, when she used the word accountability, I realized, I was like, we have two different perspectives of our relationship. You are under the impression that because we follow each other on Instagram, we are in relationship with one another. I am not under that impression. So now I'm aware, I'm like, oh, you're not even wrong. In everything you're saying to me about why you're hurt by this thing that you perceive me to do, you're not even wrong. You're correct. If we were in relationship with one another, what I did was hurtful, but we're not. So I'm right and you're right. I'm wrong and you're wrong, because we're coming at this from two totally different ideas of what relationship even is.
That is it. That's exactly it. Oh my God. It's not, to me, it's not the conversation about, should we like talk to the people in our lives whenever they've caused harm and whenever they don't know something. To me, that answer is absolutely yes.
Yes. Yep.
If they will listen, you know, like my really evangelical father, I've decided in that relationship that like there is a level of boundaries that I have to maintain, that like information is not going to help change behavior. But there are relationships with people who are eager to learn. And this is what's really tricky, is we're doing this thing with people who are actually willing and eager to learn, where we're causing, I believe, more harm for people who actually want to be doing in creating change. So to back it up, I want the people in my life to bring forward when I do things that hurt them and also hurt others.
Yep.
Because of my lack of awareness, what I didn't know previously. And that those conversations, always, I leave them feeling so grateful that I have people in my life who are willing to tell me the truth.
Yep.
What you just pinpointed is so key, is that in this social media age, and with Instagram, especially if you're a content creator who's creating things that you share vulnerable information, the relationship perception is different.
That's right. Yep.
It's like, oh, you don't know me just because I am posting on the internet.
Yeah.
And so if you have something like, and I don't want to say this and make people feel like they can't, I can't make people feel anything, but you know, the assumption being that I don't want to receive information. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing something like I actually really like that information, but I'm not okay with this accusation. And the assumption that we're in a different relationship.
Yep.
Because then the expectations, like you're saying, like this person was looking to you and being like, you hurt me by what you did because I feel bullied. But you're like, this was just like what I was thinking about this morning. I didn't even think about you. I don't know you.
That's right. Which is why I'm like, she's not wrong. She wasn't wrong then. She still isn't. We're not connected on Instagram anymore. And I'm very much like, we just were at an impasse, because that's the point where I realized, I was like, oh, we have to just different. And again, I'm not right in what I think relationship is. And I'm not saying that she's wrong or like immature. That's not it. It's just like,
just
I got to this point where I was like, oh, you have an impression of your proximity to me that I don't share.
And now for your second most downloaded podcast episode of Everything Belongs, episode 5, Moving Trauma to Trust with Rachel Maddox. And I have to admit, I listened to this one 3 or 4 times, because the things Rachel Maddox shares in this episode about trauma and healing and wholeness and blueprints of health really shifted the way that I relate to my own healing. So let's dive in and listen to what Rachel had to share on one of my favorite parts of the episode.
One of my goals, and I think one of the things that makes Rebloom different than other trauma approaches, is, can we use mythology? Can we use story? Can we use a little bit of a more relatable approach to this complex, deep, dark, scientific kind of thing? So we might call that a more feminine approach to the masculine norm of trauma resolution. So yeah, the way I lay it out, and in the book, which is coming out at the end of the summer, there's an allegory that tells the story of the 7 archetypes and how they are basically part of this village. And what happens, how actually colonization and white supremacy create a collective trauma spell that then essentially dismantles the natural health of the village. And it happens in 7 unique ways. And so the archetypes move through a developmental cycle. And the developmental cycle starts at the youngest age of development, moves to like your eldership. And this developmental arc follows a metaphor that are like archetypes of a garden. So we start with the soul seed. And yes, like you said, each archetype has a natural blueprint of health and a traumatic imprint. And the traumatic imprint can express itself, can like in the world look or manifest in both hyper expressions and embodiments and hypo expressions and embodiments. So the hyper would be versions of hypersocialization, hypervigilance, fight or flight. And the hypo would be versions of collapse, freeze, depression, chronic illness. But how they relate to specific traumatic imprints or wounds looks differently. So we'll start with the first archetype, which is the soul seed. Your soul seed. And the soul seed is your little baby self. And it connects to your umbilical cord, the part of your body where in your mother's womb, ideally at a blueprint level, you first learned how to receive everything you needed. And so the blueprint of the soul seed is worthiness and receptivity, the embodiment of I matter, I'm designed to grow and thrive, I can receive everything I need, is an intrinsic receptivity that's built into your physiology from the very beginning. It's the first thing you learn. And that first embodiment teaches you that you are worthy of being alive and you are worthy of growing and thriving. And the first core traumatic imprint is neglect. And that's when in some way, shape, or form, that receptivity gets cut off. So the mother isn't fed or something happens traumatic at a very young age, or even up through the ages, you can experience emotional neglect or neglect to your true self or whatever that blocks your sense of I can receive what I need to grow and thrive. And this makes you feel unworthy. And when you feel unworthy, one of two things happens, the hyper or the hypo. So in the hyper response to neglect, is hyper self-sufficiency. No one else will feed me what I need. I'll just feed myself everything I need. Mm-hmm. I'll take care of that. And I'll take care of everyone else. And I won't ever need anyone or anything. Needs? What are needs? I don't have any needs. I take care of myself.
Mm-hmm. I relate to this. Like, I created the hashtag, I am my own responsibility. And then I was like, could this have been birthed from over responsibility and not letting anyone in? Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
it's been a work, and the work was around worthiness. That makes so much sense. This over or under expression of
right
being able to receive and be nourished. Wow.
Right. So yeah, it's deep, right? So there's actually two hypers with the first one. First one is hyper self-sufficiency. The second one is deviance.
Oh, interesting.
So, okay, inside my safe family unit, I'm not getting my needs met. It's a version of hyper self-sufficiency, which is I will go outside of the bounds of safety and get that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go have the affair with the older person. I'll go have drugs and do drugs and alcohol. I'll steal. I'll overeat. I'll do these things that make me feel like I can receive what I need.
In unsafe ways that can actually potentially hurt you. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are the hyper. We can take a deep breath with that.
I'm just like excited. I'm doing my best to contain myself because I'm just digging this information into the way that you're communicating it so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we'll just go through the first two kind of more in depth and then just like move more.
People can buy your book.
People can buy my book. Plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the hypo with the soul seed, the hypo response to neglect is self-denial, which is I must not matter. I don't even exist. I can't feel my needs, which is kind of similar. You know, there's a little dissociation from your needs and hyper self-responsibility, but there's also a clinging to get them met. With self-denial, there can be a real starvation of your needs that happens. And that can lead to depression. That can lead to the next core wound of exploitation, right? If I don't think I matter, if I don't need anything, I'm going to let people take whatever I have. So yeah, self-denial. Mm-hmm. I don't matter.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And with the self-denial, I don't matter, can you give an example of what that could manifest as in just practical life for an adult woman?
Yeah. I don't matter, so I'll overwork. I don't matter, so I won't eat lunch. Even though I'm exhausted and tired, I can't even feel that I need nourishment. I don't matter, so I'll stay up all night and not get proper sleep. I don't matter, so I won't ever say how I really feel in a relationship. I don't matter, so I won't make requests that benefit me.
Mm-hmm. Or even feel that I have needs to make requests on the behalf of goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was chatting with someone via the social media yesterday, and we were just talking about how even just saying the need that we have is such a win.
Yeah.
So just being able to, let alone communicate it to a partner, it was in the context of communicating to partners and communicating to others, but even just to say, oh, wow, I have this need, and had a really, really vulnerable experience. It was vulnerable for me of requesting to be invited by friends to something. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is such a young version of me that's like, oh, I'm not invited. But it was a really big deal for me to allow that part of me to come forward, to acknowledge her, to bring that need. Like, I was like, I have to really celebrate all of the developmental steps it took me to reparent and to honor, to get to the place to say, regardless if you, how you feel about this, I'm mm-hmm. going to center the need in the relationship.
Oh, I was so really beautiful, proud of myself. So vulnerable. Oh my gosh, you should be. High five.
Yeah, high five in the Zoom. So from what I'm hearing you say, because of the developmental stage and cycle, they move, like the lack of one getting met could lead to the lack of the next one or a traumatization in the next sense.
Yeah, exactly. So the okay. soul seed's the first, and we spend the most time with our soul seed. And actually, even just what you were saying about just naming your needs. So one of the cool things about the Rebloom model is there's this coherence practice, which I will be running a class on soon, that has a movement and affirmation process for each of the archetypes that helps you embody the blueprint. And the affirmations for the soul seed are, I am here, I am now, I matter, I'm worthy of feeding my needs, I'm designed to grow and thrive, I need, I need, I need. And you just name what you need. And then you imagine yourself receiving those needs and what it would feel like to receive those needs. And you say, I am receiving, I am receiving, I am receiving. Mm. Yeah.
What do you find are the biggest resistances? Because you're working with a lot of coaches, a lot of people who, like yourself, I'm sure, in your mid-20s, were like, I've been doing this self-development thing for a while. And just hearing you say these things, I am imagining myself, especially in the last 2 years, like go from self-development to healing some deep trauma. And fuck, it feels vulnerable.
It's so
and it feels, immature. Like you said, I was 13, but I was 26. Like, because it's like the part of you was 13.
Yeah.
She was.
Well, and also with the soul seed, you're always going to feel a little bit vulnerable. Even me, I'm in this beautiful relationship and like, I have to say things that I need. And sometimes I just feel so embarrassed and I'll say, I feel so embarrassed to ask for this. But what's cool is you develop capacity to feel uncomfortable because you know that it's worth it. Mm. So if we just go back to this developmental cycle a bit, when you're born, right? So you're first, when you're gestating in the womb, you're receiving everything you need without having to try. You don't have to do anything. You're just receiving what you need, ideally. Then you're born and the umbilical cord is cut. And what happens?
You're relying on someone.
You're relying on someone. You're sensing that you have, you're sensing the discomfort of that disconnection that was originally seamless. And what do when you feel that discomfort as a baby?
Cry.
You cry.
Cry out.
You cry and you reach your arms out and you say, give me, hold me, I need. Mm-hmm. And then ideally you're responded to. Mm-hmm. And so the three developmental goals of the soul seed is to be able to feel and sense your needs, cry for and ask for your needs to get met, and then receive them when they happen.
Allow yourself to receive them.
Allow yourself to receive them as, like, with the knowing that that's actually how you're designed. You're designed to receive what you need. So people have a lot of resistance. Yeah, people have resistance to being needy or to feeling so vulnerable. But this needy vulnerability is the foundation of your humanness. You will never escape it. So you might as well embrace it.
Absolutely gorgeous. And our number one most downloaded episode was, unsurprisingly, with one of the people that I began the journey of 2020 with in Hawaii, Dr. Hillary McBride, talking about being our body. So here is the number one most downloaded episode of 2020. You are your body.
There is something to how you stay in yourself and open that really fascinates me. And I'm curious if there's something there that you can speak right to that is scientific and tangible of what's going on there.
Oh, what's going on there? Okay. So First, these things are so hard to speak of because embodiment, when we look at it through the history, the philosophical history through which we kind of get that language and understand it conceptually in the West, it's experiential. Mm-hmm. Embodiment is beingness. And as the philosophers would say, it's really hard to describe something that is without leaving it in some way. Like, we have to kind of get outside it to use language, because language isn't held in the same part of our body as the lived experience parts of us. We actually have to do a little bit of translating to be able to speak about anything that we feel and sense and live through. So language is always a reduction. And I don't know why I felt the need to say that, except if we could all be together, we would know things in a more implicit, clear way without having to trying to translate them into the right or hopefully adjacent words, just to kind of get to what it is that we felt and know. So that makes all of this stuff kind of complicated. And I realize that every time I talk about embodiment, I'm only really approximating it. But I like to start by defining embodiment, because that word is thrown around so much, but I've also seen it used in ways where I'm like, I don't know if that's what this means. And so for me,
it's a buzzword right now.
It is a buzzword. And I've seen people use it to, like, sell products or describe, like, you know, this, you're only really embodied when you're dancing in a kind of sexy way. And I just get really curious about how we have even reduced this being human to these very specific slices that tend to support gender scripting or misogyny or capitalism. So again, right. I want to bring it all the way back.
Ooh, there's so much there.
I feel hot and I feel a little agitated when I think about the co-opting of the body again. And even as we've tried to do body liberation, how that has been packaged and sold to reinforce a particular social story. So when we think about what embodiment is from a scholarly perspective, it's the experience of being human. It's the experience of being a body in a social context, which means that we are holding these two things in tension. You are your body. There is no you that exists outside of your body. And that body exists in a time and place with social rules, with power and privilege that reinforce or change how you experience yourself. And so these two things are constantly in dialogue, the embodied self and the context that we're in. Mm. And the ability to notice those things and be critical about them is actually separate from the experience. That the experience of feeling like we move into a space and we realize that there's nobody else that looks like us in that space, or there's nobody who shares the same identity in that space. And so we kind of shrink back and our shoulders get small. That's embodiment. But so is feeling like you're full. And so stopping, like when you stop eating because you're full, or when you realize, like, I'm tired and so I'm going to put myself to bed. That's just as much embodiment as it is being critical of the social discourse that shapes all of those choices that we make about our bodies. So I know that embodiment is a buzzword and we think about it as this like new thing and this really kind of expressive thing, and somehow movement is involved in some way. But embodiment is, when I think about it as a social movement, it's the remembering of ourselves. We have always been bodies, but in some social context, we've been encouraged and rewarded for leaving our bodies.
Right.
We have always known something. We're born like, you know, kids take keys and put them in their mouth because they're like, this is the way that I experience the world. I put everything inside my body and I touch it and I feel it and I smell it. And the sensory orientation to the world is primary. But then that's like squeezed out of a lot of us, depending on the cultural context that we're in. And so embodiment as a social movement is about remembering the things that were taken away from us based on our problematic social discourses and doing the intentional collecting of those parts of ourselves in simultaneously tearing down the structures that prevent the remembering in the first place. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all of like kind of the technical jargony stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to go more into the history in terms of how embodiment came out of continental philosophy. I don't sense that's what you're asking for or what you're getting at.
I'm curious. I'm open to it.
Okay. Well, we can come back there if you have more questions.
Okay. Sounds good.
But I really want to answer your question about me and the practice, which is something that, again, I've cultivated because of my discipline. So as a therapist, when we get into training, what we're trying to do primarily in the early years of being this listener and question asker and attachment figure is to really see the other person. So we're really paying attention to what are you saying, but how does your body match or not match what you're saying? And how does the tone of voice that you're using it with give me more or less information about what's happening inside of you? Mm-hmm. And then there's something called micro attunement that we learn to do, which is to notice like, oh, I saw a very slight flicker on your left eye. And that tells me, I've seen that before and it showed up right before you cried. So it tells me maybe sadness is on the horizon. So this like really detailed attunement to another person. But there's this other complicating element, which is that we are a self in the room, and how people say things to us and what they say about their lives and how they look and how they sit stirs up stuff for us as a therapist. And so being aware of what's happening in me so that it doesn't further complicate what's happening in the room is the process of becoming aware of countertransference. How does what you show up in the room as stir something up in me? And what are my reactions and projections to you? So we start to see not only is the therapist aware of the patient, but to do good work, they have to be aware of themselves.
Right.
But then there's this other kind of like, oh, it's complex, this thing where I have to put some of the stuff in me on the shelf to be able to fully attune to you. But if I remove all of the elements that make me, gone is my sensitivity, gone is my attunement and my empathic response. So the ability to kind of slice out some of the things that complicate interpersonal connection, but stay fully present to hear another person is just something that I've practiced for years and years and years and had, supervisors say, you flinched when the person said that. What happened in you? Go do some work around that. Okay. Or you got tight, or it seems like you're posturing yourself, or your body language changed when that person came in the room. What was going on for you? Go do some work around that. So that I have become, through the eyes of another person, which is often what we do with our patients, become so much more aware of how my body is speaking to me at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And I like to think about that as having multiple tracks of awareness open at the same time. So I'm tuned into what's happening in the other person. That's channel one. I'm tuned into what's happening with me. That's channel two. And I'm tuned into what's happening between us and how we're dancing in the space together. That's channel three. And to be, I would say, a competent therapist means being able to read all three of those channels at the same time. And so I think just like learning to speak multiple languages, this is just a skill that I've practiced through thousands and thousands of hours of training, supervised training. And it has allowed me to, let's say I'm by no means a master of this. I don't know who could be, but be really in tune with myself and be really open to and available another person at the same time without those being in competition with each other.
I love that so much because a part of it feels really healing for the journey of healing from codependence and the ability to not fully leave, which in my history has been quite a disassociative response of overly attuning outward, but not feeling inward, and to recultivate that. Whenever I say and experienced you as being fully open, but boundaried also, like at the same time, and what a safe experience that is to trust you with yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
And to me, that is what a person living in their sovereignty feels like. It's like, I can be in relationship with you because I trust you to take care of you. Yes. And that way I can take care of me, and between us, we can have a beautiful relationship.
That's right. Yeah.
That's so good.
Oh my gosh. Isn't that the best ever? And that to be able to notice that difference, like I'm so struck too, Madison, by your finely tuned awareness. I know that that can be a hallmark of having some kinds of codependency too, is like over awareness of the interpersonal dynamics. But there's also a superpower in that too. Like it's a kind of giftedness that often we have to develop if we've been in difficult interpersonal situations, but that doesn't make it a gift any less. And I think of it as being so important that when that finely tuned awareness gets turned back on ourselves, and we're like, and not in a critical way, but in a, oh, I noticed something shifted for me, and I have the resources and the scaffolding to be able to go inward and explore that in such a way that helps me know myself more.
Yeah. Feels so good. And the experience of safety that those kinds of relationships that I'm really personally moving into, and then watching a lot of my clients move into, is this lots of experiential, this idea of embodiment that is dancing or, you know, I'm going to go outside to get embodied, but just to be here with you and feel me is embodiment.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's it.
This is what gets me so fired up, is it, I feel frustrated when we take decolonizing practices, when we take human experiences that actually are sacred and slow and methodical and available to everybody, and we package them in such a way that we make it feel like it has to look a certain way to be valid. Right? That you have to be doing this kind of practice to be embodied. Like, no, if you noticed you were hungry and you ate, you were embodied.
You're doing it. Wow.
You're doing it. You're doing it.
Thank you so much for listening and offering your time to Everything Belongs this year. In the 6 months since starting this podcast, there have been 14,000 downloads, 48 abundantly generous reviews, 2 one-star reviews, which I'm taking as a strange compliment that you chose to send your energy my way. Thank you so much. And heaps of messages thanking me for really going there. And for that, I have to say thank you so much. Thank you for being with me in 2020, the most playful, somehow profitable, and soul-stretching year I've had in business yet. Thank you to the clients I've worked with, from Awaken Her Soul to the women in Rising Sovereign, who make this work so meaningful to me. Thank you for trusting me with your process, your heart, and trusting me to trust myself. Thank you so much for the privilege of seeing you. It is such an honor to see you. Thank you for every DM, review, yes, even the 2 1 stars, for every comment, share, like. Each one of you who came to workshops, did the challenges, and tuned in, it means so much during a year where attention was pulled in so many different directions. Without you, like Robin, I'd be dancing on my own. And although I'm not above that by any means, it's so much better to dance with you. There have been so many things about this year that I have wanted to absolutely spit out. And as we move into another year, I'm offering myself space to really digest it all, to let go of what isn't and was never for me, to consume less of what my body doesn't agree with, to crack wide open to the bitter medicine of stories that offer sweetness in their being told. So I'm signing off for 2020. I'll be back next year. It's been good. It's been weird. It's definitely not been what I expected. And somehow it is all here belonging inside of us. Thank you so much for listening.